All right, everybody, thank you for joining us this second seminar for our industry track. This presentation is Brewing on Premise, the Evolution of the Revolution. Our speaker this morning is Rob Larson. Rob co-owns Hi-Fi Homebrew and Barbecue Supply in Clearwater, Florida. Rob's been homebrewing for over 20 years and is Siebel certified in sensory panel management, professional beer tasting and styles, and master of beer styles and evaluation. Rob's also co-authored the book Craft Beer Tasting Journal, featured on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and many other online retailers. And in his free time, he teaches beer education classes to the Craft Beer Academy. Many of you that attended our last seminar saw that, we talked about varying your offerings and ways you can diversify your shop. And Rob's going to talk a little bit on the brew on premise model that I know back in the 90s had a little bit of its first spurt, but we're starting to see it come back a little bit and as a way to reach out to new customers. So we've certainly been looking forward to this presentation and thank Rob for coming. Will everyone please join me in welcoming Rob Larson.
Hi, thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here, an honor to be here speaking today. Love Baltimore. It's nice and from Clearwater, Florida, and it's really hot and humid right down right now, so I'm glad to be up here where it's humidity's low and it's nice out. I'll go through the introduction here. I started homebrewing back in college in Minnesota, Mankato, Minnesota, in 1995. Our GPAs all dropped that semester. So it was a lot of, and my friend Todd got me into it, and I was just the assistant brewer. He was kind of the one running the show. We continued homebrewing. My better half, Lisa, who's my wife now, surprised me with a brew-on-premise birthday party at Vine Park Brewing in St. Paul, Minnesota, in 2003. It was a lot of fun. We kind of got the idea there, where if we ever wanted to, start a kind of a beer thing of our own, we'd look at a on-premise facility. I really got into home brewing, which we moved to Florida even more. In 2007, I had about 10 beers on tap, three different couple of Keezers. So also about 20 pounds to add to that for my weight. I started blogging about craft beer in 2010. I used to write for a friend's wine website that was real popular. I co-founded Coppertail Brewing Company in 2013. I was the vice president and the director of beer development, and also ran the sensory program and off-flavor tasting. With Coppertail, it sounds real prestigious, but most days I was just sitting back in a hot warehouse brewing in a propane system. So not quite as glamorous as it sounds. I developed a website for all the local breweries where they're all listed, and there's maps and all that kind of stuff, too. Kind of a much-needed thing for our area in Tampa. I left a Hi-Fi, wanted to kind of do my own thing. I started Hi-Fi Homebrew and Barbecue Supply, which is kind of what this seminar is kind of about, kind of what we've done in about adding a brew-on-premise facility to your homebrew store or brewery. And we opened in 2015, about a little over a year ago, so we're fairly new to it, learning a lot of learning by error, I guess. And we're actually applied for our federal brewer's notice. We're going to open a brewery in our back area where the broad premise is, too. It'll be kind of a dual thing here coming up, hopefully in September. We applied in March, so we're just kind of crossing our fingers with that. So Hi-Fi is where we're talking about here. Again, we're opened in 2015. We have homebrew and barbecue supplies. We wanted to pair it with something different than your traditional beer, wine, that kind of stuff. We have that, too. We get the barbecue. I'm a big barbecue guy, so we want to do that. We do a lot of classes. We do small, we do your extract, your basic brewing class. We do all grain classes. We've done classes on recipe development. We've also just a whole bunch of different stuff. Brew on premise, we do pretty well back there. We do beer, wine, and cider. Beer is the 19 out of 20, brew on premise is beer. We don't do a whole lot of wine and cider on premise. It's been a lot of fun, and we've had that was part of the business plan initially. We had that going right from the start. We get the Grindhouse Brew Labs, our brewery opening in September. We can't go with Hi-Fi because it's there's already a Hi-Fi brewing, so we can't really do that without getting sued. So what is Brew on Premise? It's a place where customers can brew, ferment, and package all in one facility. Most people come in, they choose one of our recipes. We've got 50 different recipes. So they choose one of ours. Once in a while, I get people that come in with their own ideas, and we'll work with them, or they'll want to kind of add ingredients or you know, do whatever. A lot of people are getting into the Belgian stuff and adding different things. You know, I want hibiscus in this, or, you know, stuff like that. Federally, the TTB looks at it as it's just an extension of home brewing. So it's like they're home brewing, but instead of doing it in their garage or, you know, or wherever, they're doing it at your facility. With that, there's certain rules, and there's no license as long as you follow the guidelines, federally anyway. But a beer cannot be used for commercial use or sold by individual. Then it looks like you're too much like a brewery, so they won't let you do it, which is probably a good thing. Certain things is a brew on premise facility you can do. Employees cannot rack, transfer, treat, or package beer. So once you want to define wort and beer, wort is before the yeast hits. After that, it's considered beer. So basically, once the yeast touches, it's basically hands off. So you can actually furnish unfermented wort. You can just say, here's some wort, you know, pitch the yeast, and that's yours. Employees, some things we can do is BOP facilities. We can move fermenters. So if you want to, you know, move it to a warmer space or move it from the brewing area to the fermentation room or whatever you have, you can certainly do that. You clean and sanitize, obviously. You can actually check the gravity and perform quality control. So you can take a taste sample, make sure it's doing all right, you know, that kind of thing. You can't add anything. Once the beer's fermenting, you can't open it up and dry hop it yourself, you know, or anything like that, add oak chips, anything like that. The brewer would have to do that, the person who made the beer. State and local laws vary. Down in Florida, they just follow the federal guidelines, but I know some states do make you get like a little like brewer's license to do this. So it all depends on the states, and it's something you want to research definitely before you know, go out and spend a bunch of money on stuff. So, the attraction of Brew on Premise, it's a unique experience, and it's a lot of fun, and it requires, you know, no skill at all. You can just, anybody can do it, and that's important to, with your marketing to, you know, to push that. And also that, you know, we're the only ones around who do this activity, you know, kind of set yourself apart from competitors in other places, in other places where they would spend their entertainment dollars. It's also a great place where aspiring homebrewers can kind of test drive the hobby without buying equipment. I'm sure all the homebrew store owners in here have people come in, and you can kind of spot them, you know, initially when they come in, they're apprehensive. They don't... you can tell they're kind of nervous, and they're just not quite confident to brew it at their house. But, you know, boy, they, you know, for a little more, they can have you walk them through it. And they do that a couple of times. And also you have a customer who's coming back, buying ingredients, buying equipment. So it's a great way to get new customers in. Educational, a lot of people find it. We talk about the brewing process as well as the history of craft beer and craft beer. Usually I'll kind of run through the IPA story and the shipwreck and all that, and you know how, you know, hops and grew it and all, the whole kind of, it depends upon what the groups want to hear, but a lot of them are really interested in beer history and learning about, you know, craft brewing and even like the craft brewing rise in America and in Tampa area. We'll kind of go through that too, and you know, we get a lot of positive comments that they, you know, they really enjoy that kind of thing. Some people just want to be left alone and do their own thing, but a lot of people really want to kind of learn. It's also an entertaining group activity. We do a lot of birthday parties, and it's great. People can kind of bring their friends in. We get corporate outings. Bankers love to come in and brew beer for whatever reason. I'm not sure why, but but I would have never guessed, you know. Bachelor parties, of course, you know. We've actually done some. We did one for a large, I won't name them, but the largest matchmaking online company. We did an event for them, which was a lot of fun. You know, so you had it's like a mixer, so everybody's nervous in there, and they're kind of, you know, guys on one side, girls on the other kind of thing. So I was really nervous, and I was nervous for them. But it was fun for us. We kind of made sure we broke the ice and, you know, tried to get them to interact. They were great about giving us some, you know, some cues on how to do that. So it was a lot of fun. It's also, I think, you know, even on premise, our prices are, you know, it's for the experience, then you get the beer too. So you get to come back and you get a couple cases of beer. And I think it's a good value. The beer alone, it's about the price you'd pay for craft beer. And the fact that they get to brew it and do all that too is really, really kind of like a good value for people. Another thing we get is brewing is, you know, we're inside in an air-conditioned facility. So, you know, if we do get guys like extract brewers, especially who come in and they don't want to brew when it's 95 and humid in Florida in the garage because that is no fun. So we do get that, and it's also a push to groups to, you know, hey, it's nice inside. It's not like we're outside here with this big system or something. We do a lot of gift certificates. It's Brew on Premise Degree is a gift, especially Father's Day is coming up. We're pushing that. Christmas, we sold a whole bunch with Christmas, so it really does good with that. And you get the DIY crowd, kind of the people who want to say, you know, tell their buddies, kind of brag their buddies, hey, I brewed my own beer or whatever. So it's, you know, kind of bragging with that a little bit. And we do some special event brewing. We have people brew for birthday parties and have the beer at the birthday parties, or they'll do that for weddings, that kind of thing too. And you can really set the product apart with like custom labels, and there are various ways to do that. We'll kind of go through that a little bit. Let's go to the next slide here. Kind of the history, a quick history of it. It was big in the 90s. It kind of follows the ebb and flow of craft beer. In 1995, there were only 8 in the U.S., 55 in 1997, so it just blew up in the mid-late 90s. It originated in Canada as a way to kind of avoid the excise taxes, and also a way to kind of grow the home brewing community. The ones in the U.S. initially, a lot of them were standalone BOP facilities. That's how they did, and it's tough when you only have one revenue stream. But it started declining in the late 90s, early 2000s, and part of it was the craft beer boom was kind of dying down a little bit. Like other parts of it is it's tough with only one revenue stream to really make it. It's a retail business here. So it started to rise in the 2010s. You started seeing more pop up. I would say most today are multifaceted. They have other components that complement them, whether it be a, you know, homebrew store like us, or a brewery, or a, you know, a restaurant, brew pub kind of thing. You usually don't see it just by itself anymore. And you're seeing innovation on the rise with the current BOP facilities. Benefits of adding a BOP, more money, you know, additional revenue streams. It's always good. A unique service to set yourself apart from other homebrew stores in the area. A chance to educate and create new brewers. Press for the store brewery. It sounds pretty cool to people that you can brew your own beer at a place. So you tend to get, you know, some of the press contacts. Even after, you know, the press release goes out, you'll see it kind of start trickling in. We've had a few news stories on us as far as, like, in the newspaper. And we did, like, a morning TV program, you know, and that was cool. So we had to be there at, like, 4 a.m. and brewing a one-gallon batch of beer on air. Just, yeah, making beer and drinking coffee. BOP also helps to push other revenue streams, which is great. Some of those people might start brewing, so also you're selling them brewing supplies, you know, a couple weeks later. We sell barbecue supplies too, rubs, sauces, injections, different various smoking woods, that kind of thing. And, you know, probably half the time people walk out with some different dry rubs and things, so it's kind of a good way, kind of a push-pull with that. You bring in customers who wouldn't normally come to the store. You know, if they're doing it as an after-work event, you know, this part of the people might not even be that interested in beer, but they want to go and check out this and have some fun with their coworkers. And all of a sudden, you know, they're giving a bottle to their friends or they're talking about it to their friends. So it's a great way to kind of word-of-mouth advertising. So, or a way to do that. Challenges. There's a lot of challenges opening a BOP. just make sure you know the TTB regulations, state and local laws, of course. Cost is always an issue. Space, you got to make sure you have adequate space. You can kind of do it large or small with that. Zoning and fire code, just all kinds of kind of what you go through opening the store too, I guess. Something that's unique is managing different works. You might have 3-4 groups brewing, and you got to try to keep them all on schedule and make sure, you know, you're cooling it, you know, cooling effectively, and you know something sitting around quite a while. So we like to stagger them. Is how I do it. Recipe design, you know, if that's not something you're comfortable with, you got to make sure you find some good recipes too. Steps to adding BOP, you got to kind of follows the challenges. Review the TTB guidelines, state and local laws. And you can decide, you have to decide what you want it to be. Do you want it to be some, you know, massive BOP operation, or do you just want it to be a few kettles, you know, with kind of a cool area? Set your budget, do a space analysis, you know, how would things work best here, how would it be most efficient. Decide on your system size, type of brewing, you do extract with specialty grains, all grain, you know, you've seen varying different degrees of that. Recipes, theme style, are you going to be industrial themed, or are you going to look like a, you know, Northwoods Lodge, or, you know, I don't know. Seating, are you going to have a, you know, you have bar tables, what kind of goes through the aesthetics, what you want it to look like, you know, you're going to have more family friendly, more look like a bar, you know, it's all kinds of things you can do with it. I'd say with that, just have fun and do it kind of your style, you know. Aesthetics, you know, just kind of the whole picture, what do you want people to see when they walk into your BOP. Some of the more, as far as the system works, you know, you got to consider your kettle heat source, you got to, you know, can't power or solar yet, I don't know, but chilling method, you know, how are you going to chill the worts? Water, electric, gas requirements, you know, are you going to have to upgrade your electric service? Do you need a gas line run? You know, do you have water pipe back where you need it? Cleaning and prep areas, making sure you have adequate cleaning and prep areas. Fermentation vessels, what are you going to, you know, use, you know, the bucket brigade, or are you going to, you know, buy, you know, nice stainless conicals, how are you gonna do it? Bottling, packaging, labeling, and drainage cleanup requirements. So just some other fermentation rooms, a big one with space too. You gotta figure out how you gonna keep at fermentation temperature. A lot of places use a fermentation room, which we do as well. And I got a portable AC, I just keep it right at 66. There's different ways to do it, you know. I guess with tables or bar, make sure you have space for that. Make sure you have storage space and storage space for bottles. Then a bottling packaging area, too. Usually that kind of doubles as the prep area in our case. The brewing area, too, you got to make sure that's kind of clean and makes it easier for people to get in and out of. Usually the prep area kind of separates the brewing area from the seating area, so it's a nice flow. System size, traditionally with the original systems, they were 10 to 12 and a half gallons. It would get higher cost, which can be kind of more profitable for the facility, but it's more of a hindrance. It's more expensive for the brewers too. So it's kind of give and take with that. You would get big groups of people in there, and you see with the 5-gallon systems too, where they can kind of get a few friends on each one. Then they'll kind of mix and match the bottles when they're done. You know, so everybody gets kind of a variety of beer, and that's kind of fun. We do 5 or 10 gallons. 5 gallons, you're seeing that more and more. It's by far the most popular option. We do 5 or 10. And even though the 10's a better value, the 5-gallon, it seems like the lower class just appeals to people a lot more. It's something they can try out. So system size, I mean, you can go bigger than that too, but it's easier to get somebody to spend $100 than $180, you know, for this. Kettle power, it's a few different ways you can do it. You could use the traditional steam power, like they did with the Canadian systems, say the Price Schanstrom in Ontario, the original ones, and they're beautiful. They're copper clad. They got the nice piping going across. It looks really sharp, high end. some of the downfalls. You got a boiler with that explosion risk, and you know not everybody can just work on a boiler. They look fantastic. The valves are, you can easily control the heat with the valves. They're set in place, so it's a little more tough to clean, and they got like a hatch, you got to open up and clean it. And they're expensive. They don't make them anymore too, which is, makes it tough, but they're going for at least $7,000 to $10,000 for, then you got to hook everything up too. So it's, quite an investment there with that. Natural gas or propane, the nice thing is you don't have to modify the kettles, so you don't got to, you don't have to hook up a steam line to them or anything like that, or put elements in there for electric. They can be loud. I remember like my old jet burner, I was home brewing a thing, you'd have to turn the radio way up just to drown it out. They're inexpensive. I mean, how much is a kettle in a propane burner? You can go real kind of inexpensive with that. They're easy to install. You're generally not hooking a bunch of things up to it. Some of the downfalls, you might have to have it outdoors. Obviously, a flame risk and liability, in carbon dioxide risk as well. You probably don't want to do it in an enclosed area without proper ventilation. I wouldn't even do it inside, I don't think, to be honest. Kind of the newer wave you're seeing is electric, with all the electric brewing has came about the last 5-6 years. You go elements or induction. Right now, induction is still, I think, too costly and kind of tough to do. But it's attractive because elements are kind of, I use the Blickmans, the boil coils, and they're kind of tough to clean in there. And I use two in each one, 120 volt, the 2250 watt elements. And it's kind of tough to clean. I know they got the ones with the TC fittings now, too, that you can take out. So it's a lot easier to clean. So some different ways to go that way. No boiler or tank needed, which is nice. Just a kind of a standalone unit. So it's not like you got a big gas line running through. Electrician will probably be needed to run all the power to that area. You might need to upgrade your electrical panel. Luckily, I have a friend who's an electrician, so that helped. I could kind of trade some beer for some electrical work. It is whisper quiet. If you're used to propane or anything like that, they're really quiet. So that's kind of the advantage of that for the electric. Water concerns, of course, brewing is real water, water exhaustive, I guess. But you're going to need heating, chilling, drainage, and filtering are concerns that you have there. Piping hoses, sinks, NSF water hoses, pumps, silicone tubing are other things you have to worry about with the water or keep in mind. Chilling, different ways, methods to chill the wort. Immersion chiller, the easiest of the bunch, kind of the lower end, I guess, as far as not needing a pump and all that. The nice thing about the immersion chiller is obviously that you're sanitizing the chiller in the wort, in a boiling wort. So you put it in 10, 15 minutes out, and you're good. It's the least water efficient, so you use the most water with it. We use immersion with ours just because I don't want to drag out all the pumps for each one. And it also, we have the piping. You got to worry about the drainage. We used to do the piping right through the sinks, but I really don't trust our plumbing that greatly. So now I pump it all out through our back warehouse door, which is like 30 feet away. It's not a big deal. You can use counterflow or plate chillers, which we do too. Just make sure you have proper filtration in there, so you don't plug up your counterflow chiller, which I've done a few times. That's no fun to try to unplug. And you also got to, you got to pump the hot wort through to sterilize that stuff. And you always have to worry a little more, I think, about bacterial infection or some kind of infection. And also, in this part of the country, it's probably not a big deal, but, you also take into consideration ice. Down in Florida, our tap water is right now 85 degrees. In Minnesota, it was 55 in August, and here it's 85 in June. So you have to, at some point, circulate ice water through to cool it a little more. So you got to kind of work that into your time and setup. Heating, your water heater, you're going to need water for cleaning. And it's nice to have, warm water, too, to fill the kettles with. Whoops. So you can go traditional with a big water heater. You might already have that. You just need to pipe it back. Or you could do, instant on right by there, which is becoming more popular. I know a few facilities have that, and that's really nice to just be able to put in, 150-degree water right in the kettle. Gas or electric, it's 240 for the, or 220 for the electric. And, of course, having high temp hosing if you're using pumps kind of factor that in. Cleaning-wise, you want to make sure the kettles are clean, and you're going to need a three-compartment sink to really clean things properly. Mop sink, of course, which I'm sure everybody has. Hand wash sink, flooring. Make sure you don't want carpet or something. Probably not. Drainage. Make sure you have either floor drains or you're draining things out. Then you have to worry about cleaning chemicals, where to store them. A cleaning system. Make sure you have a system in place for cleaning after each batch. One of the things, tough things, is bottle washing. You go through a lot of bottles at the BOP facility. So we have our own system where I'll rinse them with one thing, then I'll soak them in sanitizer, then let them dry before we fill them. So make sure you have a system in place that ideally a nice dishwasher with a sanitized cycle would be nice. We don't have that luxury quite yet. But if you could, we just have a system where we have a bunch of bottles at once with jets going up through them. So it works pretty cool. It works pretty good. Aesthetically, you want to think about, how you want the place to look. You want stainless steel. It's nice. Stainless steel is nice. It's easy to clean. It's sanitary. That's what we use. If you want to go higher end, you put granite everywhere. It'd be pretty cool, I guess, marble or something, and you give it a more upscale look. We kind of went industrial with ours. And you can need equipment tables, too, and prep tables. We ended up, I think, between the fermentation room tables and the prep area and the brewing area, about seven stainless steel tables, plus racks for the box, something like that. So you need a place to put the fermenters, that kind of thing. Equipment, scales, all kinds of stuff. As far as the, where people, it takes about 4 hours to brew, with us anyway, 3.5-4 hours. We walk them through the entire process, so they get ingredients, then milling the grain themselves and doing different things. And you want, if they're in back for 3.5 hours, there's downtime. You want people to feel comfortable. You just don't want them sitting around at some, tiny table and feel cramped or anything like that. You want, make them feel, you want comfort, but you want function. You can put a bar in if you have room, tables, chairs, bar stools, other seating. You can turn it into a lounge, like lava lamps and sofas, a lot of the sofas all around or something. But it just depends on how you want it to look, what your theme is, what your style is. Some things you want to look at, what materials you're using. You use stainless steel, you use, wood, what do you want it to look like. Flooring-wise, you want, tile, you go concrete. There's some really nice concrete finishes. You just want something that's easy to clean because things do get spilled, and you can certainly do one type of flooring for, by the brewing area, then something a little more aesthetic, looks a little better, in the area for where people are kind of hanging out, so where the bar with the tables and stuff are. Just keep in mind what kind of furniture you want. In my mind, you want it to be inviting, memorable, and comfortable. You want them to feel at home in there. It'd be a place to kind of want to hang out because it'll be there, like I said, 3-4 hours. So you don't want to, want them to be able to have fun and enjoy themselves. Fermentation vessels, different ways to do it. This is kind of most inexpensive, the most expensive options. Buckets and liners are pretty common in the BOP industry. It's what we use too. The liners are great because it's a one-time fermentation, surface. So you're not using the same surface time after time. You still have to clean and sanitize, obviously, beforehand. But your infection risk is reduced. It's a one-time surface. Also, cleanup's easy. You just take the liner out, tie it, and throw it away. I mean, it's pretty simple. Sort of scrub and put a bunch of chemicals in there and the whole works. You go carboys, glass or plastic. You see a lot of places do that. And that's cool, too, because people can kind of watch the fermentation process. You could have a, if you have a fermentation room, you could have a window in there where they could see all the, all the fermentation taking place inside the carboys. So you do see that. Plastic conicals, nice. You can reuse the yeast, some of the benefits for that. So you're not always buying new yeast every time. And also plastic conicals, too, they're fairly inexpensive. Compared to the stainless steel conicals, which are, everybody wants, but they're, especially starting out, they're not, it's a big investment. It's a lot of money in those. They are really cool, though. So. As far as the fermentation space, you can kind of go a few different ways. You just have to ideally keep it at temperature, whether you're doing ales, lagers, whatever. You can go to the economy level, where if you lived in a place where they had basements, you could have a basement-level room or some kind of room that's just kept at temperature, whether you keep the whole store at that temp or, San Diego or something. You can go that route, and that'd be the easiest, cheapest way to do it. It'd be really no modification at that point. Intermediate is the way we went. Temp-controlled room with a portable AC or window AC works great. You could set it up like that. Kind of the next step, again, past that is using chest freezers or refrigerators with temperature controllers. However, if you do any kind of volume, trying to lift fermenters in and out of refrigerators is not an easy task. Good way to throw your back out. Then the advanced, if you really want to go high end, which would be cool, if you had the money and the space, well, the space for walk-in coolers would be nice. You could do different zones with that. You can set them up like that. So that's one way you can do that. Another way, too, which is would be really nice, is glycol jacketed fermenters, where you chill with glycol and keep it at temp that way. And either one of those two ways, or the chest freezer, is great to do lagers. Most BOPs, I think, only do ales, just because you keep an ale around 65 to 70, you're doing pretty good. Lager, of course, is a cooler fermentation temperature, 45, 52 or so. Packaging, certain rules. I went through this earlier a little bit. But yeah, customers can't package the beer. They got to bottle it themselves. We require two people to bottle, because one person trying to bottle is just not a lot of fun. Employees can't carbonate, rack or transfer, can't move fermenters. Or they can move fermenters, but they can't clean and sanitize. So just kind of going over that. Packaging, a few different kinds of packaging. The most common is bottles. We use the 22-ounce bottles. They look great, and it's easier to clean and sanitize, for 5 gallons, 24, 22-ounce versus 48, 12-ounce. And I think they just have a higher quality look. People associate the bombers with more quality, I guess. That's part of the reason we do it. Most places, BOPs, and advise anybody who's opening one to kind of do the same with the bottle exchange. So we have people, they pay a certain fee for the bottles. Then they can reuse them for free, or they can, as long as they're clean, or they can bring them back and you get $10 back. We give them half their money back with that. Or they can bring in their own bottles. You do want to emphasize to the customers, though, that make sure they're clean. We've had one of our first customers came in with he's going to bring his own bottles in, and he didn't have them cleaned, so I'm like, well, you're going to have to clean them real quick, and a cigarette butt came out. I'm like, that's it, you got to buy your own bottles, man. So. Yeah, no, that's not. So we put the kibosh on it right there. One thing we're seeing more is kegs. People actually just go to hey, I like this, I want to do this a few times. Instead of paying this bottling fee, how about you just buy a keg? And a lot of people have a kegerator, so they just have to change out the Sankey connections for the ball locks, and also they get their homebrew on tap, which is kind of cool. It's really not that much more for them. We get some customers too who are actually homebrewers who just want to brew at our facility. They'll actually bring in their own kegs, fill it up. It's easier for them, easier for us. I think as time goes on, you're going to see other kind of cool packaging methods come out. Crawlers are kind of an interesting idea to me. I'm not sure they'd have the lifespan you'd need for that, but some different things with that. I'm sure there'll be some others, too. Bottling-wise, for the most part, if you're just adding it to a homebrew store or somewhere you're not a licensed brewery, you can't carbonate the beer for them. So we most places kind of do it old school, where you transfer to a bottling bucket, take your final gravity, that kind of thing. Then the customer adds the dextrose, so the priming sugar, stir it in real well, then fill the bottles up and cap it just like you do at home. And I like that. I think it's kind of fun for people. You know, you kind of get a little assembly line going, and it can switch off halfway through or whatever. Some places, you know, if you're a licensed brewer, you can actually carbonate the beer beforehand, which I think's, you know, a better product for the consumer, as far as they can drink it right away. They, you know, you don't have anything going to happen in between the time the priming sugar goes in and when it's carbonated, that kind of thing. But you know, if you're gonna do it without being a brewery, there is a way to do it. The customer would need to transfer to the keg and hook the connections up. Then the customer would need to operate a counter pressure filler. And they've got some neat ones on the market with the counter pressure fillers. Some of the tabletop ones, or you could just use a beer gun or a regular counter pressure filler with that would work. So a few different ways to bottle. Capping, different cap colors are kind of neat for people to choose from. Bench capper's great. We use hand cappers. We tried a bench capper, and it was just easier with the hand capper. So not much on that one. Labels are neat. Usually with the BOPs, the labels are optional, and it's the same with us. We do have stock labels available, so you can get, you know, the honey cream ale forever summer, and we got a little label we made up ourselves. Those are extra. But there's a real opportunity with the labels to upsell, especially for people making things for events. And you can do that in-house. We do that a little bit. But it's kind of neat nowadays. You can outsource that. We use GrogTag, and actually we have a code for them, so they get, like, some money off on that. So we don't have the headache of that. Of course, we don't get the proceeds from that either. But labels are kind of fun. A lot of people get into them. Some people don't care. They just want the beer. But especially for events, weddings, birthdays, that kind of thing. All right, so say you got the BOP facility and you got it set up. There's a certain flow you want to kind of achieve. You want, you know, the process to be efficient and for people to kind of enjoy their experience. And before they get there, you want, you know, things like the water preheated if you don't have instant on water. Get everything cleaned up, the equipment, prep tables, that kind of thing. Have the ingredients ready. If you're not going to have them, get them on their own, or make sure you have enough of everything, you know, to go in back looking for a bag of grain or something like that. And you also want to determine, you know, whether you want to stagger the times. That would be done, when you're scheduling the appointment itself. Like I said, we stagger times, so we don't have four worts that need to be chilled at one time or anything like that. The arrival, we usually do the introduction by the brew coach, usually me. We get the ingredients, kind of, you know, go and get the steeping grains, get the malt extract, we get the yeast, the hops. We'll talk about each ingredient a little bit, a little education there for them. People love to do the milling, and some places do like a Corona mill, you can do that. We just dump, you know, put it in a big motorized mill, and people get to flip the switch on it, and they get a big kick out of that. So it's fun. Brewing-wise, usually you get the grain steeping or the if you're doing all grain, you get the mash going, get it started in. If you're doing the steeping grains, which most places do, after that's done, you drain it, of course, then add the malt extract, get the boil going, add the hops, cool it down, transfer the fermenter, pitch the yeast, move the, you know, make sure it's labeled all nice, schedule a bottling appointment, that kind of thing. We found one of our biggest challenges, and I think this is for BOP facilities that are starting up, is marketing advertising. Most people don't know what brew on premise is, and if you call it brew on premise, people still don't know what it is. They're even more confused. So I think you have to be clear and say this is a place you can brew your own beer, then come back and bottle it and take it home and drink it. And I think people understand that a lot better than calling it brew on premise. Especially if you're in an area where you're the first brew on premise, you know, we had one in our area back in like the 90s, but there's not been nothing since. So it's really, a lot of it's education. Here's what we do, you know, and this is what it, you know, anyone can do it. You're obviously unique. And it's, you know, affordable. It's, you know, the price you'd pay for regular craft beer. And, you know, the money you spend a night in the town at a few breweries, you could probably get a whole 5 gallons worth. And it's high quality. It's the same craft beer as you can buy, just high quality as you can buy at the breweries. And also, advertising is great for groups, great for, hey, you want to have your birthday party here, or, your corporate event or whatever, bachelor party, And make sure people realize it's fun, it's an entertaining, thing to do and just a great time overall. Challenges, funding, state and local laws, space, drainage, utilities, kind of touched on that earlier. It's nothing you can't work through. The big one, I think, is the state and local laws, besides the funding. It's just make sure you know what the state laws are on that and make sure you can work with that. Challenges, if you're not adept at setting up systems, are you going to, what kind of system are you going to use? How do you set it up? Are you capable to do that? Are you going to bring someone else in? One of the things we learned quick is, if you're using, make sure you have backups of everything. If you're using a pump, make sure you have a backup pump, because that pump's going to fail you at the least possible time. So it's proper fermentation temp. You have to have some way of keeping a fermentation temp. So whether it be a rumor or glycol or whatever, reducing infection risk. Just make sure your sanitation procedures are set in place and you follow them. One big thing is documentation. In working at a brewery previously, you want to make sure that you have a label on there that's not going to come off with the people who brewed it, the type of beer it is, the original gravity, and the date. So you don't go in there and what beer is this again? That's no good. So we keep a record, and when people brew, we have a sheet where at different times they have the hops, so they have it all in front of them. And we keep those sheets as well. So other things, bottle stock. Make sure you have enough bottles, because sometimes people will be out of bottles and you need them. So it's good to have at least two sources. We use BSG is one of our main suppliers. We use them. Usually use them for bottles, but we also have a local company we go to who has bottles as well. So it's nice to have a couple different options there, so you're not panicking at the last minute where we're getting bottles. And then clean and sanitizing bottles. Just you probably want to have a system where you can rinse a bunch at once to do them all individually. It's not real time efficient. So just some of the challenges of, it's just getting your systems in place and setting it up. It's something you figure out after a while, but it's better to kind of check it out beforehand. Some of the challenge with marketing and advertising, education, telling people who you are, what you do, and making sure they understand that, this is where you brew beer, and this is, you brew your own beer here, you take it home after you bottle it up in a few weeks. Small group events, we do, I think you have to, with brew on premise, you have to think outside the box, and not everybody wants to come in and are eager to brew their own beer. And we do one called Brew and View, and we combine a movie with the brewing. It's a small group, and everybody takes like 3 bottles home at the end, when they come back and bottle it up. And during the downtime, we get everybody going, get the beer brew going, and we start a movie. And usually it's like a comedy. You don't want Schindler's List playing or something like that. You want it to be fun. So, you don't want some heavy drama, but usually it's some comedy. And we bring in a different crowd with that. It's like a popular date night thing. But those people probably wouldn't come and brew beer with us if it wasn't part of that. And it's an inexpensive, compared to a whole brew, too. So stuff like that's fun. We did a beer and barbecue class that went over pretty well. People would brew, and during a downtime, we'd have a barbecue class going on, too. So kind of a two-in-one thing. Event plannings, finding groups who want to come in and do events, reaching out to them. You that a lot of places usually... We've actually had people come in and solicit us, for their business, then end up coming back and brewing. We didn't actually buy their services, but they came in and used us, which I think is kind of fun, kind of different. Social media posting can be a challenge. I mean, that's a great way to spread the word out for free. And we all, it's easy to do. It takes a couple minutes, but often it kind of falls by the wayside. So keeping up on that and being consistent with that. And same with one of the great ways to get things out there too, and another thing that kind of easy to fall by the wayside is newsletters. If you've got a newsletter, you know, with your homebrew store or brewery, whatever, you know, it's easy to tack on, hey, we're opening brew on premise here, and you just hit a large audience right there. Signage in the store, same thing. External events, you could get the word out that way. We do that once in a while where we'll go to a beer fest and serve the beer and have information out about it. A lot of them want to charge you a vendor fee, so if you can kind of target the ones that don't want to charge money, it's always a positive that way. But there's a lot of people just looking for, you know, come to my event and it's for a good cause, and you know, if you donate some beer, we'll let you have a space and get the word out for you. It's a great way to you can have a little drawing, we usually do that, then it's a great way to kind of build your newsletter list too. So what does today's BOP look like? It's compared to, you know, back in the 90s, it's smaller and more electric. You know, 5-gallon options, you know, it's not all just, you know, the same systems, not all the steam systems. So it's changing. It's some, a lot of different looks out there. Some places use propane, different things, so a lot of different looks. More batch size diversity kind of goes to the smaller. You can, you know, a lot of times you can choose different, you know, what batch size you want. And you're seeing some all grain options too here and there, you know, especially with the all in one systems and some of the recirculation systems too, really can make it easier. I would, you know, some of the all in one systems where you know, where it kind of brews itself, I would stay away from that because people want the experience of brewing their own. They, you know, people come in for it. I always say it's, you know, an experience for people to come in, and you want them to really walk away feeling that they had something unique. And if they're pushing a button, you know, on a machine, it's hard to really to get that for them, even though the consistency, I'm sure, is great with that. All right. You're seeing a lot of business and product pairings nowadays where, you know, back in the old days, you just had a lot of standalone BOPs. Breweries, homebrew stores, bars. See a lot of places that have, you know, some taps where people can, everybody, like, you know, if people are there brewing as a party, they want to have a, you know, probably a few beers or a few, you know. Restaurant, brew pub, if you can have food around with it, that's great too. So it's wine, cider, mead. We do wine and cider as well, but you certainly add mead to it. I know places try to make it more family friendly too. I have soda, so, you know, the parents can brew the beer, then kids can make soda, you know, so it's some different options. You can go that way. In the future of brewing on premise, are you going to see more variety, more diversity? They can offer different things, have more beer styles. I think you're going to see an increased number too. It's an easy way to add to a revenue stream. It's, you know, you can do it fairly inexpensively, you know. Additional beer pairings, you know, if you could, you know, make your own pizza or something, or I don't know, you know, kind of, especially for the do-it-yourself crowd, if you can add, you know, I know there's places that you can bake your own bread, but, you know, maybe in a couple of years people can distill their own liquor or something, I don't know if that ever becomes legal or not. More product choices, though. And I think on the beer side of it, we've looked into this somewhat. You know, it's the craft beer audience is becoming more experimental and looking for different styles and more flavors. So some of the trends, sour, you know, sours and barrel aging, you could try to incorporate that somewhat into a brew and a premise model. It might be, you know, I think it's a little too soon for that now, but I think it'll come to a point, you know. I mean, kettle sour would be tough. You don't want to try to do that, but barrel aging, especially with kind of a group brew where everybody pitches in so much and ages it in a barrel. Recipe customization, we do that now. A lot of people come in, and we'll work with them, you know, and try to, you know, if they want to use a, if they're making a stout and want to use Belgian yeast instead of, you know, English or American, we'll work with that with them. Or if they want to dry hop or add a treatment, if they want to put a vanilla bean in there or you know, hibiscus or whatever, they can do that, or oak chips. And I think, too, the future is going to be more innovative small group classes where it's, you know, more of an experience coming in. It's just not for the brewers, where you're trying to reach out and grab the craft beer drinkers and just some of the people looking for an entertaining thing to do on a weeknight, you know, or a weekend, or, you know, making to kind of grab that crowd as well. So I think that's the future of brew on premise. So any questions, though?
What percentage do you think, or maybe you know this, what percentage of, you know, people that come in actually
I would say, you know, probably as high as 30%, 20, 30%. It's surprisingly high, yeah.
So you've actually picked up quite a lot of customers just by doing
that. We have, yeah. It's a great way to add new customers to the business. It really is.
Hi, Rob.
I wanted to ask, how do you manage internally, how do you manage the sign-up? Is it like an Eventbrite page? Is it purely phone call? How do you schedule? Say you're usually the main brew coach. Say you were a shop that wanted to have four. Talk a little bit about logistic assigning tasks. And then if you're going to do a website, say for your brew on-premise versus your homebrew site, do you suggest doing that completely separately, or do you marry them all under Hi-Fi?
We married our website's one website, and we just, you know, in hindsight, I kind of wish I'd have separated it because it does get a bit confusing when you got eight different areas in a website to kind of navigate through. I would recommend, you know, creating completely different websites. Our sign-up is by appointment, so people call up for an appointment, and I'll have, you know, most of our appointments are on weekends, and so I'll stagger them about 45 minutes apart just so I'll have, you know, usually there's some downtime, so the one group will have downtime. We'll be walking through the group with the next one. I've got someone help me with that too, so it's not just me. Sometimes if we're busy, I usually have someone else there give me a hand with that. With our small group stuff, we have sign-ups on Facebook and through our website, you know, so just reservations required. We actually, one good way of doing things, we hadn't really touched on it, but we've used, like, Living Social for the Bruin View, and we get a lot of people with that, you know, and it's cost effective because a lot of it's just your time, you know, so you can actually, you know, if you charge a certain amount, it's easy to kind of recoup the and still make a decent profit on it that way. And we used another one initially to kind of get out there with the Bruin premise through a local coupon site, you know, online site kind of thing, kind of like a group, like a local Groupon kind of thing. So. Hi, go ahead.
I know this answer is going to vary with different state laws, but in your case, what government agencies or departments are you inspected by? Is the health department involved? Are you considered a food service?
No, we're not really considered a food processing center, so we're not required that way. It would depend upon your state, though. So,
How do you handle potential customers that get discouraged when they realize they can't drink the beer the same day and have to come back later?
Yeah, good question. I tell them they can drink it. It's just going to be warm and flat. So.
I got a couple more questions for you. Like, how often do you guys do classes, and what's your group size that you found that works?
We do classes basically once a month for the small group. In the group size, we've had as many as about 15 or so in there. Usually eight people per eight people per kettle. So with the small group stuff, we do it more. It just seems like if you have too many options, it seems like also you have events where you've only got a couple of people signed up for. So we kind of consolidate them into once a month with those.
Hey, Rob, great talk. I own a brew on premises in Brooklyn, New York,
okay. Awesome.
And I've had it for about 5 years, and doesn't happen that often, but it just happened this weekend. Had three people coming in the bottle. First guy's like calls up 11:30, coming in at 12.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, I'm hungover. I can't come in.
Yeah,
screws up my flow completely.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I have any recourse. You know, what am I going to do? Well, we're going to smash your bottles then. I mean, what do you do? So, how do you handle that sort of thing?
You know, if it's really going to screw up through all that much, we just have them reschedule. You know. But yeah, people do show up late, unfortunately, and we just kind of work with it. You know, I don't want to discourage anyone. I don't want to, you know, I want their experience to be positive, so I just try to work with them. And so I'm not sure there's the perfect answer for that, but yeah, I don't want to be the bad guy and discourage them and stuff like that. So I work with them any way I can, and I've stayed late to wait for people to bottle. You know, I've done all kinds of things. So
Hey,
go ahead.
Thanks for the talk. So it seemed to me that all of this requires a really large initial capital investment and then some pretty high recurring costs also. So for somebody getting started in a venture like this, how long approximately before this kind of thing would become net profitable?
You know, it was slow starting out, and it takes a while to build up. But, you know, you can start small with the brew on premise. You know, a couple 10, 15-gallon kettles with electric elements, you know, and in a little fermentation area is not that much to get going with. So you can do it, you know, relatively inexpensively and kind of grow from there. I mean, if you want the nice steam system, you're going to be forking out quite a bit, but, you know, and stainless steel conicals and all that. But, you know, you can do it, you know, relatively cheap, especially if you've got the plumbing back there and that kind of thing. You know, if you already have a sink and all that, it's, you know, you can really do it inexpensively. You're welcome.
Hey there. You guys were mentioning trying to include more family-oriented. How do you guys handle kids? Do you guys let them there?
We generally don't get kids in. We try to keep it kind of family-oriented, but we don't. You know, it's tough for kids to be there that long. You know, and if we do, a lot of times they're real young where they, you know, the babysitter fell through or something like that, you know, so.
Do you guys actively discourage that? Like bringing kids? I mean, I don't want to tell people not to bring kids, but I am afraid they're going to, I'm afraid they're going to get hurt is what it is. I don't mind having kids around, but I mean.
Yeah, no, I think it's safe. I mean, we got the brewing area separated by the stainless steel tables,
okay.
You know, so it's not like they're by a hot kettle or anything like that, you know. We do have a bar in there, and we're open to brewery, so, you know, kid-wise, it's kind of tough, but, you know, it's and there's really nothing for kids to do, you know. We do have one in once in a while. It's never been an issue, you know. I don't think you'd want, like, 20 kids in there running around, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I think if you did want it family-friendly, if you could set something up with soda and some activity for the kids, that'd be great, so.
Hi, Rob.
Hi.
How many systems, kettles and whatnot, you know, how many brewing systems do you have set up and how many can run concurrently and how much, floor space, square footage do you think is dedicated to the brewing on-premise operation?
Yeah, good question. We have four kettles we can run. Generally we run two or three at once. We have three 16-gallon kettles and one 10-gallon kettle we can run. The 10 is kind of a backup. We had to run power back there, so we have a bunch of outlets, you know, up by the brewing system. It's electric. So we could add more if we want. I'd probably have to upgrade our power, you know, to do that because it's to bring that much back, fair amount of load on your system. As far as square footage wise, we're an industrial park, so we got a lot of square feet. I mean, you know, comparatively to some places, and we have about our whole space about 2,500 square feet in our brew on premise. We share the mill and the bathroom and all that, obviously, but with the fermentation room in the brew on premise area, it's probably 1,100 square feet. So,
how long has brew on premise been a part of your business?
We just opened February of last year, and it was from day one we were brew on premise.
And in terms of customer acquisition, has it been advertising is a small percentage of that, right? The majority of it is you reaching out to specific groups that you might think have an interest.
Yeah, a lot of it's is reaching out. It's tough though. We're trying to get the wedding crowd right now, trying to get them in. You know, with the summer. And it's tough to reach some of those, you know, especially nowadays, it's hard to break into some of those circles. So it's been that. Anytime you can do advertising where you're not, you know, or reaching out where you're not having to pay for it, it's a good thing. Festivals, if you get in there, do that kind of thing.
We focus on a lot of homebrew clubs, but what we're kind of missing is an advertising vehicle other than social media,
right,
in order to get a broadcast out.
Yeah. We tried direct mail. That didn't work at all.
Yeah.
So.
And after, 15, 16 months of doing this now, what percentage of your business would you say the brew on premises is?
I would say it's probably one-third in the homebrew store,
supply. And you think at this point you're showing a net positive return?
I think so. We're pretty close.
I mean, it's obviously good for getting in new customers who are then repeat customers.
Right.
Thanks.
But, yeah, it's, you know, it's... Yeah, I'd say net positive at this point. So, all right, go ahead.
Hi, Rob, thanks. The accountant in me is really interested in what you're charging people to make their beer at your place.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I don't mind sharing it.
We have a wine on premise, so I'm just trying to compare.
Right. Yeah, thanks. We started about $100 for 5-gallon recipes plus bottles. Bottles we charge $20, which isn't much above cost on those. For 10 gallons, it's about 160 or so starting out, you know, plus bottles. We do charge more if they want to just, you know, we basically $300 to $400 if they just want to kind of rent the area out or private groups. So we do, we do charge more for that, obviously, since, you know, they're using all the space. So those are basically our prices. We charge extra for if they want to dry hop or anything like that, we charge extra for that. We recently kind of got into keg rental where, you know, we get people who want it for a special event. And it's another avenue you can kind of go down to, another way to advertise, you know, yourself is, and they didn't have a kegerator, and so they wanted it, you know, we have a little kegerator in back that came from our house. And so we just rented them that along with the keg and a CO2, you know, and put a deposit down with it. And it's a nice way to, you know, kind of increase your market with that and who you can reach. So.
Hi, Rob.
Hi.
Nice talk. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Somebody mentioned liability. How do you feel about having people sign a waiver?
We don't, but it's probably not a bad idea. I'm not, now I'll go look up waivers later and how to get that rolling. So. I haven't stirred a multi-extract and things like that, but I really don't, you know, if I'm cooling down or there's lines running, they're quite a ways away. So their exposure to the different, you know, if it's wet back there at all, I mean, usually we have the system set up now, so we rarely ever have any kind of spilling on. But if it is wet, we don't allow anybody back there. And if it's, you know, if they're up by the kettles, we make sure they know they're hot and, you know, they're easy to reach, so it's not like it's, you know, they're at risk of hot water coming or hot work coming out or, you know, getting burnt, really. They're only up there for a minute or so at a time. So I think a big part of it's keeping that area kind of off limits until you allow them in there, you know, kind of really controlling their access. Anyone else? Well, thanks, guys. Thank you all for coming out here. It's been a pleasure speaking and kind of a dream of mine to come up here and talk about Brew on Premise. So, thanks.